The war in Ukraine has been raging on for more than 2.5 years now, with little end in sight. But just a few weeks ago, in the 895th day after Russia launched its initial full-scale invasion of the country, the Ukrainians did something that is completely changing the course of this entire conflict. Because on the 6th of August, 2024, it was the Ukrainian army that flipped the script of this war by launching their own invasion of Russia, shifting themselves into the role of the invading army for once after fighting for years on the defensive on their own territory. Early that morning, after weeks to months of quietly preparing and concentrating their forces, the Ukrainian army began crossing the border from Ukraine's Sumy province into Russia's Kursk province, in a major surprise attack that is up to this video's writing met little resistance. Since then, as many as 15,000 Ukrainian soldiers and hundreds of armored vehicles have invaded Russia's Kursk province, and they've punched roughly 20 miles deep and 40 miles wide into the country in only the first 10 days of the attack, capturing more than 70 Russian villages in the process and coming to occupy an area roughly 1,000 square kilometers in size, an amount of land that's roughly equivalent to the size of Hong Kong. And while that might not initially sound like very much, that is a lightning-fast advancement compared to what's been happening elsewhere in the war over the past 2 years of attritional trench warfare in the east. For context, in only the first 10 days of their offensive in the Kursk province, the Ukrainians ended up capturing about as much land from Russia as the Russians have captured from Ukraine this entire year to date, since the start of January, over the past nearly 9 months of warfare, at enormous costs in both lives and machinery, which is all rapidly evolving into a major embarrassment for the Kremlin. Already, nearly 200,000 Russian civilians have been given mandatory evacuation orders to leave their homes for safety further behind the front, while the border provinces of both Kursk and Belgorod have each declared federal emergencies in light of the attack, and as many as 2,000 Russian soldiers have already been captured as prisoners of war and taken back across the border to Ukraine. This major Ukrainian attack into Kursk is very historically significant for many reasons, but to only name a few, it is the biggest armed invasion of foreign troops into Russia since the Second World War, while it is also the first time in history that a nuclear weapons-armed state has suffered a major hostile invasion of its sovereign territory, which is testing the very limits of what we understand about escalation in modern 21st century warfare. So, what are Ukraine's goals and objectives with launching this unprecedented surprise attack into Russia? What does Ukraine hope to achieve by invading and occupying Russian territory? How did Russia's intelligence agencies fail to predict this attack, and how did Russia's army fail to adequately prepare for it? And how is this whole series of events becoming one of the most significant turning points in the biggest war seen in Europe since 1945? To begin to understand the answers to these questions, you first need to understand how the horrible war in Ukraine has been developing for both sides over the past year since the start of 2024. Throughout the second half of the previous year in 2023, the Ukrainian army carried out a major counteroffensive operation against the Russians, primarily in the southern Zaporizhia province, with the ultimate objective of driving across the Russian lines and reaching the coast of the Sea of Azov, thereby splitting the Russian-occupied parts of Ukraine in half in the process. They were heavily armed with Western-supplied weapons for this attack. But, as the Russians were anticipating a Ukrainian attack in this direction, they smashed themselves against very heavily fortified Russian positions in the area, and ultimately failed to make very much ground, and likely suffered enormous casualties in the process. The New York Times reported that as much as 20% of the weapons and vehicles the Ukrainians committed to the 2023 counteroffensive were destroyed in it, while the Russian Ministry of Defense claimed that the Ukrainians suffered more than 90,000 casualties during the whole campaign. Although, those numbers are heavily disputed, and Western sources like the Institute for the Study of War consider those losses to be implausibly high. Regardless, Ukraine failed to meet any of its objectives during the 2023 counteroffensive, and they burned through a huge amount of resources and manpower even trying, which forced them to shift back to the defensive for 2024 and fight against the Russians in a brutal, attritional style of warfare instead. Since then, throughout 2024, Ukraine has struggled deeply with both chronic manpower and equipment shortages. After 2.5 years of horrific trench warfare that has likely resulted in a minimum of 200,000 Ukrainian military casualties, both killed and wounded since the invasion began, finding new volunteers for the Ukrainian armed forces voluntarily has become more and more challenging as time has gone on, while draft dodging has also become more common as well. In November of 2023, the BBC estimated that 650,000 Ukrainian men of fighting age had fled the country abroad over the past 2 years since the Russian invasion began, with most of them having slipped over the western borders into Poland and Slovakia, despite the Ukrainian government's total ban on all fighting age men from being able to leave the country. And this shrinking pool of manpower for the army has been undermining the remaining soldiers' morale in multiple ways, most notably in terms of troop rotations at the front. Early on into the war, when Ukraine had significantly more volunteers, soldiers were able to be rotated out of the front about every 2 weeks and were able to enjoy an entire week off. But now in 2024, with fewer numbers, frontline Ukrainian soldiers are enduring an average of a month at the front continually, with only 4 days of rest in between, significantly affecting their ability to keep fighting effectively. In order to try and address the manpower shortage, the Ukrainian government has already adopted several reforms this year, such as by lowering the military draft age for men down from 27 years old to 25 years old, allowing most of the country's prison population, except for the most serious offenders, to enlist with the armed forces in exchange for early release. And in May of 2024, the Ukrainian government also canceled all of its consular services for all male Ukrainian citizens abroad aged between 18 and 60, including canceling all renewals of passports in an attempt to force more Ukrainian men living abroad to return back to the country again and potentially face conscription. And in terms of artillery alone, the Ukrainians were getting outgunned by the Russians in artillery all across the front line by as much as 20 to 1 before April of this year, when a new $60 billion U.S. military aid package for Ukraine finally passed through the U.S. Congress. But even after that, as recently as August of 2024, the Ukrainians have still been getting outgunned in artillery shells along the front line by a ratio of about 8 to 1. These manpower and supply issues for Ukraine, on top of the failure of their 2023 counteroffensive, shifted the momentum of the war in the eyes of many back over to the Russians again across 2024. And since the start of the year, the Russians have managed to continually make slow but steady and methodical gains across the Eastern Front with their superior advantages in both firepower and manpower. Since the start of the year, the Russians have thrown hundreds of thousands of their soldiers against the Ukrainian defenses in the Donetsk province in the east, and they've gained nearly 1,200 square kilometers of territory in the process, including the significant capture of Avdiivka that was accomplished in February of 2024, a major suburb of the city of Donetsk that had a pre-war population of 31,000 people. Since then, the Russians have methodically advanced at enormous cost across an axis in the Donetsk province towards the towns of Chasiv Yar, Kostyantynivka, Toretsk, and New York in the north, and towards the highly strategic town of Pokrovsk in the center. With a pre-war population of around 60,000 residents, Pokrovsk is a major town and a highly important logistical center for the Ukrainian army, as it sits precisely on the highway T-054. Which links several other currently Ukrainian-held cities in Donetsk, like Kostyantynivka and Chasiv Yar, and Kramatorsk and Slovyansk further to the north. As it currently stands as of mid to late August 2024 when I made this video, the Russian army has punched to being within only 13 kilometers of Pokrovsk, and if they succeed in capturing it, it will sever one of Ukraine's primary highways that they use to supply their forces in Kostyantynivka and Chasiv Yar. And then, if the Russians are able to capture those undersupplied towns next, their path will become fully opened to advance on the major cities of Kramatorsk and Slovyansk in the north next, which are the final two major cities in the Donetsk province that continue to remain under Ukrainian control outside of Russian occupation, each of them with pre-war populations of more than 100,000 people. If Russia ultimately succeeds in capturing these final two cities in Donetsk, then they will effectively complete their occupation of the entire Donetsk province, and it will become very difficult for the Ukrainians to then eject them from it militarily, especially when considering that Russia already effectively controls the entirety of the neighboring Luhansk province as well. It all starts with Russia's capture of Pokrovsk, and if they're successful there, it could eventually lead to Russia's full control and occupation of the entire Donbass region next, a major wartime goal of the Kremlin's, and which could then lead to Moscow focusing their army's next moves on pursuing their other major wartime objectives in the southern theater, completing their occupations of the provinces of Zaporizhia and Kherson too, all of which Russia has already unilaterally declared to have annexed and declared to be core Russian territories. And at the same time as this major Russian push towards Pokrovsk has been ongoing, the Russians also opened up another new front in the war in May of 2024, when they launched a renewed invasion of Ukraine's Kharkiv province in the north, with only moderate gains in success. And as a result of all of these huge Russian offensives in 2024, the scale of the fighting that's been going on throughout Ukraine this year has been at its most intense level of the entire war, especially across this summer, even more so than at the beginning of the invasion in early 2022. Russian casualties alone along the front line are estimated by Western sources to have been more than 1,000 soldiers lost per day on average since May of this year, a rate of losses that is comparable to some of the most ferocious combat seen during the Second World War. By comparison, American forces during the brutal Battle of Okinawa against the Japanese in 1945, the bloodiest and fiercest battle fought during the entirety of the Pacific theater of the war, suffered only around 600 casualties per day in combat on the island, which implies that the current state of the war going on in the east of Ukraine is bloodier and more ferocious than even that terrible battle was for the Americans. It is truly World War levels of combat that hasn't been seen in Europe in more than 80 years. And the fighting has been so brutal here that you can now clearly see the scar across eastern Ukraine from space that marks the current position of the front line. And as Russia has continued gaining ground against the Ukrainians throughout the year, there has become a growing narrative both in Ukraine itself and in the rest of the world that against its much larger opponent, Ukraine is supposedly destined to lose eventually in this attritional style of warfare that inherently favors the country with the larger pools of manpower and equipment to pull from, and that as a result, Kyiv should supposedly sue for peace sooner rather than later. In June of 2024, with the momentum seemingly on his side, Russia's president, Vladimir Putin, finally set out his own terms to begin peace negotiations with Ukraine. He demanded that all Ukrainian forces withdraw from the territories of Luhansk, Donetsk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson just to even start negotiations, and that Ukraine would have to agree to permanently cede all of these territories in their administrative entireties to Russia, despite Russia not yet fully controlling all of the territories. He also demanded that Ukraine would have to recognize the loss of Crimea as well, and formally adopt a status of permanent neutrality and irrevocably abandon its ambitions to join the NATO alliance. This offer was immediately rejected by the Ukrainian government, which so far continues to assert that peace will only be possible if and when all Russian forces leave from Ukraine's internationally recognized territory, and Ukrainian sovereignty is fully restored across all of its pre-2014 borders, including Crimea. But that doesn't mean that international pressure on Ukraine to begin making concessions to Russia hasn't been growing. A month later, in July of 2024, the Prime Minister of Hungary, Viktor Orbán, visited Ukraine's President Zelensky in Kyiv and pleaded with him to accept a ceasefire deal with Russia along the current military front line in the country, which was again refused. The month before that, in June, Switzerland hosted a major summit on peace in Ukraine that explicitly didn't invite Russia, and that saw 78 countries from all around the world all signing a communique that asserted restoring Ukraine's pre-2014 borders was the ultimate basis for any lasting peace in the conflict. But many other major countries from around the world did not agree to that and did not sign on to it, including all of the BRICS states besides Russia, like Brazil, India, China, and South Africa, in addition to Pakistan, Mexico, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Indonesia, and Thailand, among many others. At the same time, there's also been growing discontent about continuing to support the Ukrainians in the Western world. Donald Trump, who very well may be elected as America's president again in November, has vowed to immediately halt all American military aid to Ukraine if he returns to office again, in an attempt to force the Ukrainians to negotiate on an end to the war, a possibility that the Ukrainian army has to consider in their ongoing calculations. And at the same time, as the war has raged on in Ukraine for the past 2.5 years now without an end in sight, and as the casualties and burdens of the war have continued mounting, war wariness within Ukrainian society has also naturally increased. When the Russian invasion began in early 2022, polling data from the Kyiv Institute of Sociology found that an overwhelming 82% of Ukrainians flatly rejected any consideration that the country should ever surrender any of their territory to Russia in exchange for peace, which remained more or less consistent for the next year and a half through October of 2023. But after the failures of the 2023 counteroffensive and the grinding attritional war in the east that has taken place since then, the numbers of Ukrainians saying that they would consider surrendering territory in exchange for peace have increased dramatically, to as high as nearly a third of the Ukrainian population by the time of May 2024. And because of all of this pressure building both within and outside of Ukraine to surrender land to Russia in exchange for peace, and after slowly losing ground all throughout the year to Russia in the east, the Ukrainian military leadership likely calculated that they needed to throw down the dice and gamble with a bold attack somewhere to shift this prevailing narrative, boost their own morale, and to try and reverse their fortunes. And sometime this summer, they ultimately decided that launching a major attack into Russia itself would be exactly that high-stakes gamble that they needed. Over the past few years, the Ukrainians have launched a few cross-border raids into Russia, but they were always exactly that, raids. Like the ones launched in May of 2023 and in March of 2024 into Russia's Belgorod province, by only a few hundred fighters each time in pro-Ukrainian militia organizations rather than professional Ukrainian army soldiers, that both times only made small territorial gains and attacks before escaping back over across the border again. A big Ukrainian attack into Russian territory with the objective of hanging on to that territory had never been attempted. But as the Ukrainian military planners began scanning around their frontiers over this past summer, they noticed a major vulnerability. This is a map of current Russian military fortifications that have been built up throughout the front line in Ukraine in the south and the east, and along the northern Russo-Ukrainian border stretching into Belarus. This map is sourced from data that's been collected by Brady Africk, an American analyst who maps out Russia's defenses on his website. Russia's fortifications along the front line within Ukraine in the south and the east are strong because they're multi-layered lines of trenches, minefields, and anti-tank defenses that were strong enough to block Ukraine's counteroffensive operation here in 2023. But Ukrainian military planners noticed this vulnerability in the northern section along Ukraine's border with Russia's Kursk province. Here, there were gaps in between the defensive lines, and there were far fewer anti-tank obstacles, minefields, and anti-tank ditches than elsewhere. Presumably, just because the Russians weren't anticipating a major Ukrainian attack happening into Russia itself. So for months over the summer, the Ukrainians began quietly redeploying troops and equipment from across the country into their northern Sumy province under the pretense of training and picking up new equipment, and slowly built up mass there for an attack into Russia's more lightly defended Kursk province in the process. And even though this buildup of forces was being done in total secrecy, the higher Ukrainian troop concentrations in Sumy still didn't exactly go unnoticed by the Russians. After the Ukrainian assault took place in August, Andrei Guruliov, a member of Russia's parliament and a former high-ranking Russian military officer, claimed that a report had been submitted to the Russian military authorities around a month beforehand that read, quote, "Forces had been detected and then intelligence indicated preparations for an attack," end quote. Nonetheless, as Ukrainian troop movements through the Sumy province towards the active front lines in Kharkiv and the Donbass were pretty common, Russian intelligence appears to have failed to have ever capitalized on that report and to have anticipated an attack coming from this direction. The secrecy surrounding the attack was so great on the Ukrainian side that only a small handful of top Ukrainian leaders even knew about the operation at all. While most of the Ukrainian soldiers who would be participating in the attack weren't even informed about the plan until the very last moment, some of them only a couple days beforehand. The Ukrainian leadership didn't even inform their greatest international supporter, the United States, about the operation at all, which led to officials in Washington waking up to a huge surprise on the morning of the 6th of August when they had learned that hours beforehand, thousands of Ukrainian soldiers armed with American-supplied weapons had just invaded Russia. And now, weeks later, the Second Battle of Kursk rages on atop of the very same battlefield that was fought over between the Germans and the Soviets in that titanic Battle of Kursk in 1943. And just like how that World War II-era battle here proved to be a decisive turning point during that war, so too could this Second Battle of Kursk in the ongoing Russo-Ukrainian War. And while Ukraine's ultimate military objectives related to this offensive into Kursk are still fairly secretive, we have a lot of room to speculate. Early on into the attack, there was a lot of speculation that one of Ukraine's primary military objectives was going to be the capture of the small town of Sudzha, located just across the border, because Sudzha strategically contains a gas transfer station that's the only operational entry point for Russian natural gas flowing through their Brotherhood pipeline to customers in Europe. Control over Sudja therefore enables the Ukrainians to effectively control the flow of gas through the Brotherhood pipeline to Europe. But the Ukrainians aren't really incentivized to interrupt that flow of gas very much. Russia continues to pay Ukraine transmission fees for the gas that moves through the pipeline even during wartime. So them taking over Sudja and shutting off the taps would also shut down a major revenue source for them as well. So that alone doesn't quite explain their advance in this direction. Another much speculated on Ukrainian military objective here would be for them to advance about 60 kilometers or 37 miles deep into Russia towards the Kursk nuclear power plant, which is one of the top three biggest nuclear power plants in Russia today and one of the top four biggest producers of electricity in the entire country. If the Ukrainians were hypothetically able to advance far enough to seize control over it, they could end up using it as diplomatic leverage against the Russians for their own occupation of the Ukrainian Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, the largest nuclear power plant in the whole of Europe that's been occupied by Russian forces since the opening days of the invasion for the past 2.5 years now. If Ukraine seized control over Russia's nuclear power plant in Kursk, they might be able to try and trade it during ceasefire negotiations for their own nuclear power plant in Zaporizhia back. There's also several potential military objectives that the Ukrainians may be attempting to achieve with their attack into Kursk as well. President Zelensky of Ukraine said early on into the assault in Kursk that over the past 2 months alone, since the 1st of June, the Russians had used artillery in Kursk to shell Ukrainian border villages in the Sumy province more than 2,000 times. And so, the Ukrainian advance into the Kursk province has already pushed Russian artillery far enough back to be out of range of these northern villages that have been under constant fire for months now. Moreover, the Ukrainians are also probably interested in destroying the Russian Air Force's ability to utilize their air bases across Kursk to bomb positions in Ukraine. The closest Russian air base to the border here is the Khalino Air Base located within the city of Kursk itself, home to the Russian Air Force's 14th Guards Fighter Aviation Regiment and their 24 Sukhoi Su-30 fighter jets that have repeatedly carried 3-ton glide bombs across the border to bomb targets in Ukraine. The Ukrainians have attacked this base multiple times all throughout the war with drones and cruise missiles that have only caused light damage. But the recent Ukrainian advances into Kursk now enable them to, potentially, move US-supplied HIMARS rocket systems to being within range of the base, which could pummel the base hard enough to potentially knock it out of commission for the rest of the war. But at the same time, Ukraine has precious few HIMARS systems available to spare, and it's unclear if they would ever risk them by moving them into occupied Russian territory where they would be at a greater risk of getting themselves destroyed. Some Ukrainian military officials have also stated that their Kursk attack is intended to complicate the flow of Russian soldiers and equipment from other parts of Russia moving to the front line in the Donetsk province, where Russia has been concentrating its own offensive energy for months now. But this isn't very likely to succeed if that's truly the aim, because there aren't really very many rail and road lines from where they've attacked that connect to the front line in Donetsk. If Ukraine really wanted to complicate the flow of Russia's logistics into Donetsk, they would have to capture the town of Valuki, hundreds of kilometers to the east of where they actually attacked from. So, instead of complicating the flow of Russia's logistics onto the front line in Donetsk, the Ukrainian attack into Kursk is probably more designed to draw Russian soldiers themselves away from the front line in Donetsk, in order to relieve the crushing pressure that has been mounting on the Ukrainian front line there. It's also probably designed to force Putin himself into making a very uncomfortable and politically risky decision, because Ukraine isn't the only country in this war that's been suffering from chronic manpower shortages. Throughout this past summer, the Russian army has been able to slowly and methodically advance against the Ukrainian positions in the Donetsk province and gain more ground because they've been throwing huge numbers of their soldiers into combat and paying in blood with an average of more than 1,000 casualties every day. Russia has been losing approximately 30,000 soldiers a month in Ukraine recently. And so, just in order to maintain their current troop numbers along the front, the Russians have been having to replenish their troop numbers with at least 30,000 new recruits a month. And Russia is continuing to build up their forces in Ukraine even further. In July of 2024, Ukraine's commander-in-chief, General Oleksandr Sirsky, said during an interview that he believed there were approximately 520,000 Russian soldiers currently deployed on Ukrainian territory along the front line, and that by the end of 2024, he believed the Russians would increase that number to around 690,000 troops on the front. Russia's total military size, at least officially, is currently only 1.15 million active duty personnel, which means that around half of the entire Russian military's active duty manpower is currently deployed to the front in Ukraine, leaving little room left over for their ability to respond and react to other crises developing in other theaters, like Ukraine's surprise incursion into the Kursk province. In order to continue sustaining their objectives in Ukraine and the pace of their attacks, the Russian military has announced plans to expand the personnel in their armed forces up to 1.5 million, or by another 350,000 or so troops. While Bloomberg's Economics Russia economist, Alex Isakov, has suggested that Russia will need to recruit around 500,000 more people into their armed forces over the next 12 months just in order to sustain their current levels of attrition and maintain their current tempo of heavy attacks. And Russia will simply struggle with acquiring that many people for service. Back in September of 2022, after the last successful Ukrainian counteroffensive overran swaths of Russian-occupied territory in the Kharkiv and Kherson provinces, Putin ordered a limited mobilization of 300,000 Russian reservists that sparked a huge uptick in anxiety in the country and led to as many as a million people rapidly fleeing from the country in order to avoid potentially getting called up for service in Ukraine. Since then, the Russian authorities have learned to rely more on the carrot than the stick in order to acquire more manpower for the armed services, offering to pay well above market salaries and bonuses to new recruits who enlist. New recruits who enlist with the Russian armed forces in Moscow, with various bonuses all baked in, now stand to earn roughly $59,000 in their first year of service in Ukraine, assuming that they survive, which is about three times the average annual salary in Moscow and about five times the average annual Russian salary nationwide. For a poor Russian peasant from the back country somewhere with little other prospects, gaining 5 years worth of income and only 1 year in Ukraine can be a highly tempting offer, which is so far how the Kremlin has continued maintaining a steady stream of about 30,000 new recruits a month to replenish their ranks in Ukraine for a while now. But as the war continues dragging on and as the casualties have mounted to as many as 500,000 Russian soldiers, killed and wounded in total since the invasion began now, the payments and incentives to attract new soldiers are having to get higher and higher, and they may soon reach a point of becoming fiscally implausible. In order to gain the 500,000 new recruits that may be required for the Russian army over the next 12 months, carrots and payments alone will probably not be enough. And so, Russia will probably have to revert back to using the stick again and call up another politically unpopular round of mobilization. The way that Ukraine was able to just walk across the border in the Kursk province and rapidly seize 1,000 square kilometers of lightly defended Russian territory and take as many as 2,000 Russian soldiers as prisoners with only light resistance lays bare the current issues with manpower that Russia is facing and the lack of their defensive reserves. And the longer it takes for the Russians to respond to the attack and push them out, the worse their manpower shortage will appear to look like. And what kind of a message does that send to Russia's other enemies? If the country doesn't even have enough latent manpower left over to kick out the Ukrainians from Kursk, then would they have enough to kick out other incursions or invasions by other forces at other locations? It puts Russia into a position where it almost has to consider ordering another round of military mobilization just to be able to adequately defend their own borders and to continue appearing strong. And just like the last time they tried that back in September of 2022, it will inevitably prove to be deeply unpopular, as the costs of the war in Ukraine will reach even greater numbers of Russian civilians. By attacking into Kursk successfully, the Ukrainians have narrowed down Putin's choices for continuing the war considerably, while the attack has also fundamentally embarrassed Putin personally by challenging his regime's perception of strength. The attack shows that the war's consequences are not only limited to Ukraine, and they can be expanded beyond Ukraine's borders to affect thousands or even hundreds of thousands of Russians too. Nearly 200,000 Russian civilians have been given evacuation orders since the Kursk invasion began, and the whole operation also fundamentally undermines both Putin's and Orbán's peace proposals that they each suggested only a few months ago. How can Orbán's peace proposal of freezing the front lines where they currently stand be tolerable to Russia if it means freezing the front line in the Kursk province too, with a swath of territory under Ukrainian military occupation? How can Putin negotiate that Ukraine surrender territories in the east while this chunk of Russian territory is still under Ukrainian occupation? It is for this reason that Ukraine's attack into the Kursk province makes the most strategic sense as a sort of bargaining chip. By taking over and occupying a bunch of Russian territory, Ukraine has just gained a lot of leverage in potential ceasefire negotiations with the Russians that they didn't have beforehand. And they can try and offer a land-for-land-style peace in which Ukraine will give up its occupied territories in Kursk in exchange for the Russians giving up their occupied territories in Ukraine, so long as the Ukrainians can continue holding on to the territory in Kursk. And to their credit, they appear to be trying to hang on to the land in Kursk for the long haul, as they've already started digging out trenches and building fortifications in the area as they await the inevitable, eventual Russian counterattack against them. The attack into Kursk and their seizure of about as much land in a couple of weeks as Russia had taken throughout the entire year has also completely shifted the narrative of this entire war, by showing that Russia does not, in fact, hold all of the cards when going into a negotiation. And the attack has showed Ukraine's military supporters in the Western world that even after the failure of their counteroffensive in 2023, the Ukrainians are still determined to continue fighting and are capable of actually winning and achieving breakthroughs if given the right equipment. There's previously been quite a lot of debate within the US, the UK, and Germany about where exactly Russia's red lines are in the Ukraine conflict that could trigger an uncontrollable escalation towards World War III and global nuclear Armageddon. Because the West doesn't want to get itself involved in a direct shooting war with Russia, the West has been extremely cautious with providing Ukraine with certain powerful military equipment, like long-range missiles and fighter jets, out of this deep fear of military escalation with Russia. Another one of these much fretted about red lines in the Ukraine conflict for years has been Ukrainian troops marching across the border and attacking and occupying sovereign Russian territory with Western supplied weapons. But now that that supposed red line has been crossed by the Ukrainians and a major assault and occupation of Russian territory did not, in fact, lead to a nuclear escalation, Ukraine has demonstrated that Russia's supposed red lines are fewer than many expected. And they will use that example to make the case clear that other supposed Kremlin red lines can be crossed as well, such as the West supplying Ukraine with longer-range missiles and fighter jets that can help them fight more effectively. And perhaps most importantly, the Ukrainians needed to give their own soldiers and people a major morale boost after the past year plus of significant setbacks they've been forced to endure. From the failure of their counteroffensive in 2023, to the steady loss of territory in the Donbass to the Russians, to their mounting casualties on the front line, and to the frequent Russian bombings of Ukrainian cities and civilian targets across the country, such as the huge missile attack that Russia launched all across Ukraine in July, that included missile strikes on the Okhmadyt Children's Hospital in central Kyiv, the largest children's hospital in the country that terrorized countless Ukrainian children and their families. Ukraine's soldiers and civilians both needed a victory somewhere to help keep themselves going in the fight, and to give them any sense of hope that all of the horrors of 21st century warfare that they've been enduring for years will not be for nothing. But that doesn't mean that the Ukrainian attack into Kursk is not without significant risk either. Ukraine's armed forces have had to pull thousands of highly experienced veteran soldiers away from the pressing front line in the east in order to carry out the attack in Kursk. And all as Russia continues massing soldiers in the east and continues to gain ground there. Ukraine reducing their troop numbers along this front for the attack in Kursk could prove to enable the Russians to advance in the east even more easily, especially if Russia doesn't end up diverting very many troops away from the eastern front in order to deal with them in Kursk, and relies on pulling troops into Kursk from other locations across Russia instead. Indeed, since the Ukrainian offensive into Kursk began, the Russian zone advance towards the strategic town of Pokrovsk in the Donetsk province has only continued and kept on gaining ground. There's also the fear that a major attack on Russian territory that results in the occupation of parts of Russia proper could end up energizing Russia's population to become more pro-war and drive up Russian military recruitment in the process, which is an effect that won't really be well understood until months later. And then there's also the risk that Ukraine's forces in Kursk could end up becoming too aggressive and advance too deeply into Russian territory and extend their own supply lines from the border too far in the process, which could end up stalling their advance out and leaving their soldiers there undersupplied, which could then open them up to a major Russian counterattack. If the Russians end up smashing the Ukrainian advance in Kursk in a major military action that drives them all back over the border again with high casualties, all as the Russians simultaneously continue their steady advance on the Eastern Front, then the psychological blow dealt to the Ukrainians and their Western supporters will be enormous. And it would then become widely interpreted that diverting so many experienced soldiers from the Eastern Front was a grave mistake. In order to avoid that possible outcome, once the Russians inevitably start deploying more capable troops to Kursk, Ukraine really has only three options going forward with their attack here. they could try to continue advancing more aggressively in order to take over more territory and expand their leverage and bargaining position in the process. But that approach will risk them overextending their supply lines and eventually getting themselves smashed in the process. So it's the highest risk, highest reward option they could choose. The lower risk choice would be to fall back to more defensible positions in Kursk and dig themselves in and prepare for the Russian counterattack, trying to hang on to a small gain in Kursk that they could still use as leverage and still show to the outside world as evidence of their success. The second option right now appears to be the most realistic approach that the Ukrainians will actually attempt, while the final, lowest risk option that they could do would be to basically pull back across the border into Ukraine in a controlled, orderly fashion and preserve as many troops, vehicles, and supplies as possible in the process for a potential major counteroffensive operation again next year in 2025, showing that they can still surprise and hit Russia hard and undermining the narrative of their supposedly inevitable defeat in the process. It's ultimately all a huge gamble for the Ukrainians to have taken, but after the way the war has progressed over the past year, they didn't really have very many choices to consider. Regardless if the Ukrainians can hang on to their gains in Kursk or not, this has been a decisive moment in the war and one of the most historically significant events to have happened in European history this century. Now, there's a lot of data that goes into producing these kinds of videos. Whether it's showing the scale of the territory Ukraine has seized in Kursk to the area of Hong Kong, visually showing how much territory in eastern Ukraine that Russia has taken since the start of the year, or showing why the Ukrainian town of Pokrovsk is such a strategically important place for the Russians and Ukrainians to control in this war, the ability to actually visualize raw data like this instead of just reading about it in text format is exactly what makes learning about these kinds of things so fascinating to me. And it's why the Exploring Data Visually course is one of my favorite courses that I've ever taken with this video's sponsor, Brilliant.org. Brilliant.org helps you learn by actually doing. They don't just give you a mountain of text and expect you to remember everything you just read. They use interactive exercises to teach you the intuitive principles, then build these principles upon each other so that you can genuinely understand complex subjects like data visualization and analysis, statistics, computer science, astrophysics, or tons of others. They really know how to teach for results, which is why Brilliant.org is perfect for the kind of person who wants to learn because they love learning, not because they're being forced to. And best of all, with their mobile app and smaller bite-sized course chunks, it's really possible to fit learning on Brilliant.org into any schedule, no matter how busy your day-to-day activities are. So, if you're the type of person who loves learning new things, you can try out everything Brilliant.org has to offer for free for a full 30 days by clicking the button here on your screen right now, or by visiting brilliant.org/reallifelore, or by clicking the link down below in the description. And best of all, you'll also get 20% off of an annual premium subscription with Brilliant.org when you do so. It's also a great way to help support my channel, and as always, thank you so much for watching.